Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/bookgeeksunc. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For you, the listeners of Book Geeks Uncompromised, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Today, I want to recommend a book that I keep bringing up that we haven't actually reviewed on the podcast before, but that is The Shadow of What Was Lost by James Islington. Yeah. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It is narrated by Michael Kramer. He is a very popular narrator in audiobooks. He has narrated the Stormlight Archive books.
Oh.
He's narrated the Mistborn books. He narrated The Wheel of Time.
That's what the name sounds familiar.
Yeah, he has narrated some of the most popular books in fantasy and so naturally does a fantastic job with The Shadow of What Was Lost.
Oh, he's awesome, yeah.
So absolutely check that out if you are looking for an entry into audiobooks. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/bookgeeksunc. Again, that's audibletrial.com/bookgeeksunc for your free audiobook.
Welcome to Book Geeks Uncompromised.
The entire series.
I don't know what it was about this book. I loved it so much.
How do I know more about it than you do? And it's your number
one
book.
I'm bad with names, okay?
Spoilers, guys.
And we are ready for some reading.
When in doubt, be lame.
Everyone buckle up. Welcome back to Book Geeks Uncompromised, where we make reading less solitary, and sometimes I'm a little lame, but it's okay.
Sometimes.
Let me at least get the episode number out before you rag on me.
Okay, All right.
This is episode 67. I am Greg, I'm here with Danny, and this week we had a chance to sit down with James Maxwell, best-selling author of the Everman Saga and the Shifting Tide series.
Yes, and we'll say it again, but we want to thank him for coming on the show with us.
Awesome. He was a very fun interview. It was really cool. We're both history nuts, and he talked about his travels, so it's a lot of fun.
I guess we could jump straight into news. I didn't have like anything interesting happening this week.
Nothing.
Well, we were reading the Assassin's Apprentice by Robin Hobb. We're starting in with the Farseer trilogy.
Yep.
Which we're not going to do a review here. But
no. Yeah. We'll tackle that series maybe a little later on. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely interesting.
I'm surprised by how much I actually remembered of it.
Oh yeah.
Because it's been like 10 years since I read the series. Like I've read hundreds of books between now and then. Like I thought I only remembered the barest bones, but I'm surprised with how much I am remembering.
Yeah, I know we've talked about reading Robin Hobb since like Christmas because we saw it at a Barnes & Noble and you went, yeah, I remember that. And we went, sure, we'll fit it in sometime.
I've been trying.
We have,
since then. I've been trying.
We've been trying to squeeze it in, but there's so many awesome books out, so.
Okay, so news. J.K. Rowling fires the bulk of the Pottermore editorial staff.
Oh, why?
So there's not really a reason given, like a firm reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of went all over the place, the different articles to see what people were saying. Because I actually have never spent a whole lot of time on Pottermore. Like I did the Sorting Hat quiz and stuff like that, but I've never spent a whole lot of time on there.
Didn't do a whole lot on there, no.
So Pottermore was originally a place where you could read up more on characters, items, and magical objects and creatures. But in 2015, Rowling hired staff writers and made it more of an editorial website.
Hmm.
A former Pottermore employee told BuzzFeed, I think turning Pottermore into an editorial site a few years ago was a lovely idea with the potential to be great, but the execution has been disappointing. It's essentially a glorified merchandise shop with some cute articles that might appeal to hardcore fans, but don't have enough of a point of difference from the rest of the internet's writing about Harry Potter to survive.
Okay.
And yeah, that's one thing somebody pointed out was a lot of the articles was 7 things you didn't know about Remus Lupin, which I totally just like don't even read those.
Yeah.
I don't read those. You didn't know this. I'm like, I bet you I did. And it's not even Harry Potter. Like I have no interest in those types of articles in general.
Yeah. There's a couple I'll see here and there. There's a couple of YouTube videos that are that way, but yeah, generally, no, I won't be. That's not going to be an everyday thing. I'll go, oh, I wonder what Pottermore posted about something I didn't know about some character.
Yeah.
That'd be something I'd probably go through once and go, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not, I've never not gotten lasting.
Into it. Like, the only, like, Harry Potter website I ever really got into, and this was, you know, back when I was, like, 11, mm-hmm. was MuggleNet.
MuggleNet was fun.
That was pre-Pottermore.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. You know, it's weird that stuff going on with Pottermore sounds a whole lot like BuzzFeed, the one that just was doing the reporting. BuzzFeed does that stuff.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, BuzzFeed, they're, like, known for doing... Those
but they're also not like a fan site for something specific.
True, I'll give them that. But why are we reporting off BuzzFeed? Like, they're known for those stupid lists. I hate BuzzFeed so much.
A source told BuzzFeed that editorial writers struggled to write about Harry Potter lately because of Johnny Depp's role as Grindelwald in the Fantastic Beasts franchise. Reporting from inside a franchise that so values its secrecy has been limiting because there's so much Pottermore can't say that other outlets can. I'd say as an important side note that they've also suffered from a very sad waning in confidence from fans since the decision to cast Johnny Depp. So that's not something like Pottermore's complaining about Johnny Depp. It's just fan disappointment in general has led to a loss of interest in the Harry Potter franchise.
Oh, that I know we've had a discussion about that before.
So we won't go there. I mean, no. I kind of get what they're saying. But
yeah,
I don't
yeah,
know.
It. At the same time, I get that the Johnny Depp, I don't want to say incident, but everything going on there is maybe just matching up at the same time. I don't think the idea of a editorial site for Harry Potter is a good idea anyway, because it's a book series. It's honestly a book series, and you can only dissect and pull apart pieces of a book series so many times.
If you want to appeal to a very broad audience, right. Then yes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's definitely some big fans, hardcore fans who would love seeing this stuff every single day. But honestly, if you're trying to hit big numbers and you're trying to reach out to more audience, most people aren't going to care. If they're not already a big Harry Potter fan, they're not going to care.
Yeah.
And
it's not like blaming the Johnny Depp casting. That was just sort of
right.
It was just sort of a symptom, I guess.
A symptom of it. Yeah.
And I guess one person was talking about what was it? It was something with the Fantastic Beasts stuff, like Grindelwald is holding a prophecy or something. Mm-hmm. So the Pottermore, the official Harry Potter website, is mm-hmm. like, so does this mean that there's a prophecy involved? So it's like, you're the official website.
Yeah,
so
does
that mean there is a prophecy involved? Like,
you're the one you're we come to this for.
You're not supposed to be theorizing. You are the official source.
That's what the fans do.
Yeah.
You're not fans. You're so the official source.
It's like it can't quite figure out.
Yeah.
The website as a whole can't quite figure out whether it's an editorial or a fan site. So the whole point is that they're reorganizing, I guess. And I'm not sure what exactly they're going to do to stay relevant.
Yeah. Unfortunately, stuff like that, I don't see how sites like that can be unless there's new books still coming out. Which with Harry Potter, there won't be, as far as we know.
Yeah, we're just getting the Fantastic Beast screenplays.
Yeah,
because those just feels like a money grab to me.
And somehow win awards.
Yeah, it's a money grab. That is, and I kind of hate it.
I think they're cool, but
for something like Cursed Child, where not everybody's going to be able to make it to Broadway to watch the play, it makes sense. Yeah. But Fantastic Beast was in every single theater in America for 2 months.
Yeah,
and then it was on Blu-ray. I don't know.
Yeah, no, but that just kind of leads me back to our rant from December of there should be a screenplay category in books and not in awards. So basically what we're saying is Harry Potter, we love you, but Harry Potter, we hate you.
Don't ever say that to me again.
I was joking.
Okay.
Put the knife down. The knife down.
Next news story. The knife is down. So now I get to talk by myself.
Yeah, we satisfied the Harry Potter news. So
yeah, 2 weeks in a row.
Hey,
can we go for 3?
Oh, we can. I'll find some. I will find the article about the 7 interesting things about Lupin. That'll be the news story.
You would.
I would.
You would.
So what are you talking to yourself about?
I am talking to myself about Neil Gaiman's book Coraline is being adapted into a grand opera in London.
Oh God, yeah, you are. When's your ticket to London?
Oh, I'm not a huge Neil Gaiman fan. I just thought this was interesting.
Oh, then why are you talking to yourself?
I don't know, Craig.
It's a podcast. We're always talking to ourselves.
Okay. I don't know. Have you seen Coraline, the kids movie?
Oh, okay. Watched? That's that Coraline. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I do know of it. I never watched it.
Yeah, I've read the book forever ago, but honestly, I couldn't tell you anything about it. I know my kids like it.
Yeah. I know Tim Burton had a hand in that one, didn't he?
I think in the movie, yeah.
Yeah, the movie. I can generally say if it's a creepy animation, yeah. it's generally Tim Burton.
Creepy stop animation is probably Tim Burton, yeah. That's accurate.
Oh, that's cool. So it's like an opera style, it said?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. That's really interesting.
It is.
I'm kind of fascinated. Like I said, I'm not a big Neil Gaiman fan. Like, yeah. Nothing I've read of his has just truly wowed me, even mm-hmm. though I know he's beloved by so many.
Right.
But that's an interesting adaptation. Like, you know, we had the Percy Jackson musical.
Oh, we still never saw that.
I still haven't experienced it, but I need to.
We need to find a way to, yeah.
And, you know, now we've got this. I don't know. I kind of scratch my head at it, yeah. But I want to see it at the same time.
It'd be interesting for sure. Just a little side note, by the way. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a Frozen Broadway musical now.
That doesn't surprise me at all. That surprises me precisely
Not
zero.
Not going to lie, the trailer I saw made it look pretty cool.
Let it go. Let it go.
Greg, let it go.
Okay. This one is for you. A Ooh. Quick one. The Stormlight Archive VR yes. game, The Way of Kings Escape the Shattered Plains,
what?
Is out. It's on Steam.
What?
But you don't have a VR headset, so.
I'm getting a VR headset. How do I get a VR headset? Hold on. I'm getting my phone.
Purchase one, like, at Walmart.
Really? Walmart has them?
Yeah.
I imagine that'd be a really crappy one, though.
They've got, like, some Samsung ones, I think.
VR headset. I'm typing in Google right now to play Storm.
Yeah, so you play as Kaladin. The experience starts in a terrible storm, a high storm, on a desolate dock where Kaladin has been left to die. The dock breaks and you're stranded in a deep chasm. And the high storm is raging, so you're trying to get out.
This sounds like the perfect example to buy a VR headset.
Now, the game is $10.99.
Oh, that's not bad.
And it's only 20 to 30 minutes of gameplay, though.
That's what I figured. It was going to be something really short. Yeah, I figured it was going to be something really short because anything big and worthwhile, there would have been a lot more behind it. There would have been a lot more from Brandon Sanderson behind it. So I'm not going to say I haven't seen any footage of it. I will definitely be looking it up, though.
It looked really cool. Like, the images I saw showed a high storm, which yeah. looked really neat. It showed the Parshendi.
Ooh.
Which was interesting.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what they... Because I know there's drawings of them.
One thing that I really wanted to see, though, was the shard plate.
Yeah.
And then I just saw some stills, so I don't know if it's in there or not. It might be, since some of the Parshendi have shard plate.
Hmm.
So we'll...
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm just seeing pictures of it right now. I'd definitely be interested to look at that. And I would buy a VR headset for that to try that out. And I've been wanting
$500, you got it.
Let's do it. Drop it. There is a couple games I've wanted to play on VR. But anyway, that's awesome. That sounds really cool. I've been wanting to get into VR for a while. My biggest problem with it is I want to be able to walk around.
Yeah.
Like, I want to be able to physically use my legs and walk around. Mm-hmm. Because there are some you can. So with Stormlight Archive, that would be cool to actually be Kaladin.
Right.
To actually be able to walk around and move, which would be difficult to do. But anyway, I definitely am checking that out. And I'll report on how cool it is next week.
Okay. The final news story I have... A debut author, YA author's book, had to be rewritten 8 weeks before publication.
Oh, why?
So, debut author Kiera Drake's forthcoming book, The Continent, was set to be released this past January. Early reviews started coming in that claimed that her book was racist against Native Americans.
Oh.
Drake's novel is about Vela, a cartographer's apprentice from a wealthy family. On her 16th birthday, she is given a ticket to go on tour with her family to a place called the Continent, where two warring tribes battle in a lush landscape. When tragedy leaves her the only survivor of her family stranded on the continent, she finds herself living with the Avini, one of the communities. The other group, the Topi, are the main antagonists, and their depiction caused the biggest uproar among advanced readers.
Hmm.
So I haven't read it. I couldn't find exact details, just sort of references that people made that you could kind of infer what it was.
Yeah.
So many readers, including a Goodreads user, Liberty Vaz Townsend, said that she felt like the narrative that was in the book encouraged the idea that light-skinned people are more empathic or human than dark-skinned people.
Hmm.
And since it was kind of tribal, then it felt like it was
aiming towards
them. Now, after reading the responses, you know, at first Drake just wanted to defend herself and her book because it was never intended.
Right.
But ultimately she realized after reading all the responses and reflecting on the book that the book was guilty of exactly what they were saying. So she asked her publisher, Harlequin Teen, gosh, I can't speak today, to push back the publication. So they agreed to push it back by about 2 months. I think it's out now, or it's about to be out. It's coming out, I think, in late March.
Oh, wow.
And she made a lot of changes, it sounds like. Like, she removed all instances of the word of, like, savage or barbaric, stuff like that, just to move away from it. She changed the name of the Topi tribe to Zoe, I think, or something like that, because I think it was too close to an actual
tribe.
And she actually changed the main character so that she's part Aveni, which the Aveni people, and I'm probably not saying that right, it's Aveni-EI. So I'm guessing at Aveni.
Aveni, okay.
And that tribe was inspired more by Asian appearances. So she made her part Aveni to avoid the trope of the dark-skinned aggressor or white savior narrative.
Okay, I can see that. I guess I'd want to know what it was originally saying to fully weigh in.
They put on the article I was reading, they had some samples of, like, original paragraphs versus new paragraphs, and it was really subtle changes for the most part.
Yeah.
It was largely some wording changes.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, you can tell that it was not at all intended by how willing, especially by how willing she was to change it once.
To delay it for
she
long.
Realized, I mean, what she had done.
I mean, asking your publisher to delay it is not an easy task, and it's not, you know, I mean, of course, I'm sure it was easy once she went to the publisher and went, look what's being said, I need to change things. Yeah. They went, ooh, people aren't going to buy this book if we let this go out. All right, we better.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, I'd be curious to know exactly what was said, like what in the book made it, like, almost, I kind of wish I could get a version of the original manuscript to compare it to the new one.
Right.
Because there is a certain point where I think some people can overreact.
Yeah.
But with this, it sounds like there's enough people that were reacting to it, and the author herself went, whoa.
That's kind of where I'm at. Like, a lot of times you hear these stories, and it sounds like a lot of knee-jerk, you know, if you do anything even the slightest.
Right.
You know,
not
even
PC.
Yeah, not PC. It's attacked.
Yeah.
And many times that's justified.
It's warranted. 100%.
Many times it's warranted. 100%. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it does feel like it goes too far sometimes.
Well, like, I can say another case where it's a little bit warranted, it is with, like, the Harry Dresden, especially the first, I'd say the first few novels. They're not sexist, but they do definitely paint some women in that light. Not all the time. Just comparatively saying there are times it's not done on purpose.
We don't need to go into that too much. I have a couple of thoughts on that, but we have a whole podcast devoted to the Dresden Files.
And that's what I was doing, bringing it up. Go check it. No, I'm sorry. but yeah.
We discussed all that pretty in detail when we did our review for the series.
We did. But yeah, no, enough people reacted to this, it sounds like. I mean, I'd have to look more into it, but it sounds like enough people saw it. There must have been something there.
Well, and it obviously wasn't intentional.
No.
So,
no, I don't think it was.
I feel like, you know, she realized her error, so she's correcting it. I feel like that's deserving of forgiveness.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know, though, that sensitivity readers were a thing. Like, I guess they're a form of beta reader that reads the book with that express purpose to check for sensitivity.
I guess that makes sense. I mean, you don't, you know, someone who, I mean, you can't know everything about every culture, about every little thing. An author can't be expected to know everything. So if there is something, it's good that there's someone to point out and go, hey, just want to let you know this might offend these people. And to a point, as long as it's reasonable, I don't know. It's some gray area right there.
Yeah, I know some people are very worried that it's going too far. And I'm not saying that it has gone too far, but I can see that if it did, it would make some books very bland. I think that books that do go too far on that would come out very bland.
Yeah. And one,
if you're so afraid to depict your characters, I mean, you say, okay, this is their skin color, and now you have to tiptoe on eggshells around everything that character says and does. Like, I can see how that would negatively impact that characterization, even though you were going for the exact opposite.
Well, I think a big thing is that this book was YA. this book was meant towards younger readers.
Okay.
I think more adult, grimdark, or, you know, more adult novels, I think, are okay with tapping into those because a little bit. I'm not saying, yeah, every adult book needs to be racist, but they can, I think they can handle that better than YA.
Grimdark isn't good if it's not racist. Right. We don't mean that.
We don't. That for was the a record, joke.
We don't mean that at all.
That was a joke. Someone's totally cutting that and going, Book Geeks is racist. Don't cut that either. yeah, but I feel that more adult novels and books can not do that, but can dive into that and
they can, examine, in a more nuanced way.
Definitely. They can examine that better.
Yeah, I don't know. I think know.
Towards YA.
I mean, I don't want to rag on YA too much because I think that there are YA. Definitely some complex issues that are discussed in YA.
We just read a YA series that took some dark turns.
In general, I feel like many themes get kind of glossed over or generalized in YA, and that could just be my opinion because I don't read it very much.
No. My comment wasn't attacking YA. Right. It wasn't saying YA is worse thereof. But I feel like adult can tackle those issues better than YA can.
It can maybe go into darker themes.
It can. It can go into that stuff and adult knowing, I understand it. The book's not being racist. The author is showing this. This is
the message.
Yeah.
I think in all cases, and this doesn't really apply to this one, but context is important in all cases. Yeah. Context is important. Oh,
for sure. So basically, Book Geeks, what you're saying is you hate YA. Yeah. Yes. Yes, that's it.
That's it.
Thank you, Avid fan. Thank you.
Okay. That is the end of our news story. So let's go into our interview with author James Maxwell. Again, he is a best-selling author of the Everman Saga and the Shifting Tides series, which that last book of that Shifting Tides series, the conclusion, just came out this month. That is Iron Will was the final book.
Yep.
So let's dive into that.
We have with us today the great pleasure of being joined by author James Maxwell, the best-selling author of 8 epic fantasy books. His first novel, The Enchantress, the first book in the Everman saga, was self-published in 2012 before moving to a publishing deal with 47 North. That series has been followed by the Shifting Tides series, of which the final book has just been released this month.
Welcome. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
How's writing been going for you recently? How have you been doing?
I'm constantly writing all the time. So as soon as this book's out, I'm already now working on the next thing and write every day. I'm trying to write 3 books this year.
Ooh.
So it's constant, but it's really good.
That's
I'm
a
really
lot
excited.
For a year.
Yeah, it's keeping yourself busy.
That's right.
Your bio on your website mentions that you had a love of reading that translated to a passion for writing. What authors do you most attribute with instilling this love of reading?
I think when you look at books for young children, it's easy to forget how fantastical they are. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's almost a rule to have animals that talk and think like people and books that are full of magic. And when you're young, you think nothing of it. And I don't know why some people lose interest, but for me, I never did. I loved anything imaginative and escapist, and I read a lot, anything I could get my hands on. So in terms of influences, what I'm saying is I think it starts young. So I loved, you know, Grimm's Fairy Tales and The Wizard of Oz and Alice in Wonderland and Enid Blyton's Faraway Tree, and then a little older, C.S. Lewis, and then grew up a little bit more, Tolkien, and then more modern fantasy authors like Robert Jordan, Tad Williams, Terry Goodkind, Raymond Feist, David Gemmell. The list goes on. So I guess what I'm saying is it's no one author. For me, it's definitely a realm of authors throughout my entire life, really.
Oh, yeah, I know for sure there's so many people I talk to that still fondly remember Where the Wild Things Are. I know that's a big from a lot of people's childhood that they look back on fondly. So I can definitely see wanting to capture that magic again from childhood.
Do you find like going back and reading those that you read as a younger child, the pre-Tolkien, pre-Robert Jordan, are those different to read now? Like you said, because they are very fantastical as a kid, like with the animals talking and everything. Is that kind of different for you to go back and read now?
It depends on the book. So you know, if you read Alice in Wonderland now, you can read that right today, and you'll absolutely love it. It's a really cool book. Some of the other stuff, you know, I don't know if I would enjoy some of it as much as I did at the time. And it's kind of you grow up and the books grow up with you, and then you start moving on to new authors, and it's kind of this maturing process.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, like a book from our childhood, The Fly Went By, just wouldn't be the same nowadays.
Not quite as captivated.
No,
by it.
No. Well, one thing is you travel quite a lot. Born in New Zealand, lived in London, Thailand, Mexico, Austria, and Malta. These are very diverse set of cultures. How did you decide where you're moving to next?
I think each move was for a different reason and came about in a different way. So I moved from New Zealand to Australia when I was with my family at the age of 7. And then from Australia to London when I was in my 20s to see the world. Mm-hmm. And then I did a lot of traveling around my job as a software developer. And while I would travel, I would always just think to myself, you know, always at the back of my mind was this story I'd been working on for years, and just really wanted to say, oh, do you know what? I would love to live in this country and go to the beach every day and dream up ideas and just spend 100% of my time writing. So that had always been kicking away. And then the financial crisis hit London, and it hit quite hard. It was a difficult time for a lot of people, and I had a very large enforced period out of work. So that was when I kind of took the opportunity to go to Thailand and write the novel I'd always wanted to write. I had notepads full of years and years worth of ideas, and Thailand was just ideal. It's cheap and secluded, and it's a beautiful place. And the fact is, it worked. And so later on, when Enchantress was getting some traction, I really wanted to quit my job and write full time, but I wasn't really making much money, and London's a very expensive city. And so that's when I went to Mexico, where I wrote my second book. It was just a country I'd always wanted to spend some more time in after having traveled there. And then after Mexico, I wanted to go to Austria just as winter was approaching and live in the mountains. And I found a great apartment in a ski village, and I speak some German, which helped as well.
Wow.
And that was a cool experience. And I wrote my third book there. And then as the snow kind of melted away and so did the people, it kind of just felt like it was time to move on. And I'd always wanted to live on the Mediterranean, and I'd been to Malta before. And it's a beautiful place, and it's English speaking, and it's got incredible history, an amazing climate. It's, you know, everything's by the water, and there's a lot of sailing, and it's a really good place. And so I wrote my fourth novel there. And then that's when, about the same time as the publishing deal with 47 North happened, and suddenly I was making enough money to move back to London. Mm-hmm. And so part of me could have stayed in Malta forever. I was quite happy there, but at the same time, all of my friends and family were mainly in London, and it's still the place I've lived in the longest of any. And so in a way, I kind of came full circle and had this kind of bunch of experiences and writing books along the way, and then ended back up in London with a different kind of life.
Wow, that's amazing. That's really cool, the different places you've gotten to live. As a quick side note, how many languages can you speak?
I'm probably best with German after English, and I speak a little bit of Spanish, but not that much.
Oh, very good. Yeah, cool. Yeah, we're just English.
I can count to 10 in Spanish. That's about all I got for me. So in all of your travels, you went to, like I said, so many diverse, different cultures. What's one of the more interesting things that you learned while you were traveling?
It's a good question. I think one of the most interesting things, I think, is probably seeing how different cultures rub up against each other and influence each other. So it's something you don't get from travel books or even history books, because if you're talking about a place, you can't really talk about other places as well, because you can't really fit that in.
Mm-hmm.
And so an example is that you can't live in Thailand without seeing the influence of China. Or the same thing goes for Mexico and the influence of Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And in Malta, there's a surprising amount of British-inspired architecture and culture. And then before the British were in Malta, it was ruled by the Knights of St. John, who are an organization going back to the Crusades in the Middle East. And it's just amazing the way that these places kind of shift and rub and influence. And there's just something really cool about that cultural influence. And it's a little bit like books and how books can influence each other as well.
Wow, that's really cool.
That's cool, and it sounds like you're a history buff like we are. We love hearing all different points of history, especially for me. I know Greek mythology and the Greek times are a huge period I love.
Yes, definitely. No, I could talk about history all day, but it all depends on the audience. So.
Well, like you said, you wrote your first book back in Thailand, The Enchantress. Was there something about Thailand? Thailand that made you want to get back to writing? I can't speak.
I think you kind of already answered that a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was a decision to set aside a large block of time to write that came first.
Okay.
But when I thought about where I wanted to do it, it was always Thailand. It's just, it's a bit different from other places. It's very, very easy to shut out the world. There's very few distractions. It's got a relatively low cost of living, and I'd been there a few times before, so it was familiar to me. And funnily enough, there are bits of Thailand that entered the book, whether I meant them to or I didn't. For example, there's a period of monsoon early in Enchantress, which is exactly what was happening where I was. It just didn't stop raining. There's also a lot of descriptions of forests, and I was surrounded by trees the whole time.
Okay.
Very nice.
We mentioned that you were originally self-published before getting a publishing deal with 47 North. What was your experience with self-publishing like?
It was interesting. I self-published in mid 2012, and then that's when I went to Mexico, and then the next one came out pretty much 6 months later, and then 6 months and 6 months again. And really, I think, unlike some other people, I was just really kept my head down and wrote. I did some social media marketing and also some ad-based marketing and things like that. But really, when it came down to it, it was what I really wanted to focus on was getting books out and getting ideally good books out and getting feedback from people and working on them and working on them again. And so that was kind of what my experience of it was like. And it seemed to get its own momentum. And I don't know, like, you know, they say word of mouth is a very good form of marketing. And I don't know if that was helping me or not. But really, I wasn't maybe doing as much as some people are these days. And sometimes I look at what people are doing and it's so much work, you know, to do all that marketing and to really get that, to get yourself out there. And so I think I was quite fortunate in many ways to maybe strike at the right time or something to get that opportunity with 47 North as well.
Yeah, what led to that opportunity with 47 North? What led to making the transition to traditional publishing?
I don't know exactly. I mean, okay. They approached me, so I guess they'd come across the books, and the third one had just come out in the Evermen saga, and so I was, you know, about halfway through the fourth, and they just kind of struck up a conversation and said, you know, can we have a chat and can we talk to you and just see what you're up to? And then that chat, you know, that led from one thing to another. And I think the ecosystem of traditional publishing does probably suit me a little better. Whereas some other people I know definitely want 100% control. But I love having a publisher and they're really great to work with.
Okay. What is it that you like about traditional publishing over the self-publishing? Because I've actually heard from other self-published authors that in some ways they do prefer doing everything themselves, even though the marketing is a lot more difficult.
Yeah. I think it can be quite difficult to get the right help that you need. Mm-hmm. So particularly these days, there's so many people online offering writing services, you know, so editing and proofreading and copy editing and all those very, very important steps in the process. And it's hard to find good people, basically. Publishers are better at it than we are because that's what they do every day.
Yeah, they know.
So there's that argument that they provide very, very good quality people who will help you make your book be the best it can be. Yeah. And because I've always just been so quality focused, that really suits my mentality. That's a big driver of it. Another one is also once again the fact that I want to devote my time to writing. That's you know, I want to write. You know, I write quite thick books and I try and have them come out relatively regularly, which takes a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I really want to apply my energies and being able to have them help me out with marketing and things like that's really good for me.
The world of a Shifting Tide series is very reminiscent of ancient Greece. Was there a historical war that was part of your inspiration for the conflict between, I apologize if I pronounce the names wrong, Gallia and Ilia?
No, that's right. If I had to name a period, it would probably be the wars between Greece and Persia around the 5th century BC. But I was also looking at Alexander the Great's wars of conquest.
Okay. Oh, very nice.
But the main thing I wanted to capture was the fact that people were realizing at this time that if you could gain control of the sea, you could control the kingdoms around it.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was a period when there was basically an arms race in terms of naval warfare. And as people tried to gain this control of the sea, the more that city states and empires expanded, the more they came into conflict with one another. And so I wanted to tell a tale about that kind of conflict.
Yeah, I got kind of a sense of, is it the Peloponnesian War? Because it kind of seemed like Which one? I wrote down the city's names, and now I don't have them with me. But one was kind of Athens, like with the democracy and with...
Yeah, the other's a little bit like Sparta.
Yeah, right. And the other's a little bit like Sparta, right?
Yep.
Okay. So while were any of the cities based on real locations, or was that just entirely...
I mean, you know, the democratic city state I have, and then the more warlike are obviously a little bit modeled on Athens and Sparta. Mm-hmm. But it mainly came in handy to differentiate them in a strong way. So, you know, if I write about two city states in ancient Greece, it could be very easy for them to blend into one another. And whereas I want them to have very strong separate identities. Mm-hmm. And so by making one more economic, more democratic, more about artisans and dramatic arts, and the other more warlike, more highly religious, living in the mountains rather than near the sea, and really use that as different models so that people can really see, okay, this place is different from that place, and that they have their own identity.
Okay. The fantasy aspects of the Shifting Tides seems to come in a lot with the Eldrin and the Wildrin. Mm-hmm. Where did those come from? Is that any kind of a mythology, or was that just something that worked really well with your story?
I think I wanted to have something that was reminiscent of Greek mythology, but wasn't Greek mythology. And so essentially I wanted to do a modern fantasy treatment of Greek mythology, nice. Which means, you know, I wanted to have a magic system. And so by having an invented race, like the Eldrin and their dark side, which the Wildrin, then I had something that would fit into this kind of Greek mythology world where you had mythical creatures and you have giants and you have dragons and you have, you know, some of that wonderful fantasy adventure, while also not looking too much like Greek mythology with, you know, the Greek gods, Zeus and Cyclops and, you know, all these Medusa. You know, I didn't want to go there at all. I wanted it to feel like modern fantasy more than Greek mythology. And so it was just striking the right balance there so that it has more of that modern treatment.
No, and I think it absolutely did. Yeah, I didn't really get a sense of Greek mythology in it. It was just in relation to the world is what made me start thinking that. I liked the whole concept of the Eldrin, though. They have transformed into different creatures, various creatures. And then if they stay that creature too long, they kind of lose their minds a little bit. Hmm. I like that.
Yeah, they become locked into the shape. Yeah. Yeah, which is, yeah.
And that led to a little bit of a theme of some xenophobia a little bit among some of the humans.
Yeah, for understandable reasons.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got these wild creatures that can really devastate your towns and villages, of course you're going to dislike where they come from.
you tend to dislike them a little bit. while reading Golden Age, the scenes that include ships and sailing seem pretty technical. Do you have a lot of research in sailing, or did you have to do a lot?
I try not to get too technical, but it's something I wanted to communicate about the shipbuilding techniques of the time. So basically, they were already making war galleys as long as they could make them in this time. Mm. And they couldn't make them any longer. They couldn't make ships any longer, or they wouldn't have been seaworthy. So ancient Greeks, they had this idea, which was pretty crazy when you think about it, mm-hmm. of putting a bigger engine in the same size boat. Mm. So what that means is fitting in more oarsmen by putting a second row of oarsmen on top of the one below. So you have twice as much power. So a war galley became a bireme, which means two banks of oars. And then this brings back to the arms race I was talking about before, because this idea led to an arms race where people kept trying to fit more and more rows of oarsmen on top of those below. So they had a more and more powerful engine. And so war galleys led to biremes, which led to triremes, which led to quadriremes, and so on, with four, five banks of oars. And they even experimented with six, seven, which is just insane when you think about it. The boats weren't getting any bigger. They were just trying to fit more and more people on them.
How long would the oars have to be for that seventh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Just to reach the water. That's insane. I'd imagine the oars would eventually snap if you get them too long.
Yeah, there would be a limit to it. But I think they had multiple people on the oars, so...
Do you enjoy sailing yourself? Because that kind of seemed to come across a little bit. And maybe that was just with
course,
the focus on...
So growing up in Australia, I did a lot of sailing as a child. And also sailing's, you know, something that I've done in the Mediterranean and the Caribbean. And I've always had a strong personal passion for sailing. I love being on the water.
Yeah, we live, what, 8 hours from...
Yeah, the nearest ocean.
We've
got lakes, and those are, you know, with quotation mark lakes, because they're tiny little nothings, so...
Okay, so over the course of the series, the characters in the story have obviously come a long way over four books. Did you always intend for the story to go as it has, or have the characters themselves directed things in a way that you didn't originally anticipate?
There were a few moments, but generally speaking, I'm you know, definitely on the planner side of the writing spectrum. So I work with very detailed outlines, and I always have a pretty good idea about where I'm going. There were occasions when characters would come up with great ideas, which is always important as well. So as much as it's good to plan, you need a little bit of space in your plan for those things to happen. There are a few things that came to mind in terms of some plots that I was considering picking up, but then didn't. So there's one thing that comes to mind, which is one of my characters murders a king by poisoning him, but manages to convince the world, to convince everyone that he died of natural causes. So I was thinking of having the secret come out, but then I decided it was better for the story if I didn't. And so it ends up becoming a guilty secret that this character has to live with. And it's a little like Alexander the Great, you know, who may or may not have died of natural causes age 32 and we'll never know.
Okay.
Oh, wow. That's cool. One thing I've noticed with a lot of authors we've either talked to or books we've read, that the stories either tend to go character more focused on character driven versus story driven, such as like Three Body Problem we read not too long ago. What are your feelings on that? Do you prefer a more character driven story or one that focuses a lot more on the plot and let the plot drive everything?
I guess I've never seen it as a dichotomy of one versus the other. So I always think in terms of arcs. And so it's, you know, you want a story arc, but there is no story arc without a character arc that goes with it.
True.
And so without knowing what that character's arc's going to be, I wouldn't be able to plot anything. So when I'm coming up with a story, I'd like to think, okay, how is this character going to arc? How are they going to begin and how are they going to finish? And generally I like to know where they're going to end before I even really work too hard on the beginning, so that I know what kind of role of transformation they're going to have. And then I'll go back to the start and find the right starting point for them so that they can have, you know, a large amount of change. And then the things that happen along the way are, I guess, plot. But is the character driving that plot? I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, no, that's definitely a great way to look at it. I like the idea of writing the character first before fully writing everything. I like that. I like that a lot.
No, I did read Golden Age this past week. So I got through that, and I do plan on continuing the series. And I did feel like there was a good balance of both, you know, plot things happening, but the characters' motivations kind of driving that plot forward.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah, I felt like that was a good mix. Like you said, not really a dichotomy. You mentioned that there were some things that came up while writing it that you had to decide whether to include in the story or not. Were there other interesting, maybe quote-unquote deleted scenes or plot lines that you ended up removing from the series?
Not too many others that I can think of off the top of my head. There's the line that I was talking about just before about the character who ends up becoming a poisoner and then has to live with the secret. And it's always a little bit difficult to know whether to expose something like that. There's some great conflict there, but then sometimes when you've got a different conflict that you'd prefer the reader focus on, then sometimes some of these things don't get to make it into the story.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, now that The Shifting Tides is finished, with the final book just coming out, that was Iron Will, just came out, what do you have next? What is your next project that you're working on?
I'm not going to say too much about it, but okay. I'm working on a trilogy, and all three books I'm going to write back to back. One thing that I hear a lot from readers is they don't like waiting for the next book to come out, so the idea is that ideally they'll be able to be released quite close together. And also I think it's going to really help me with those arcs that I was talking about so that I can really, because I like to do an arc across a series as well as within each book. So I think it's going to really help from a plotting point of view. And it's going to be epic fantasy, but I'm bending the genres a bit more and adding a dash of science fiction.
Ooh.
and it's going to be a completely new world, and it's going to be a place that's completely hostile. And it'll be very interesting to see if my characters can survive it.
I'll definitely look forward to that, because I like the idea of the science and the fantasy magic kind of merging and seeing how they interact with each other.
Yeah, I think I absolutely love books that manage to have fantasy and science fiction and to have them work together in a very close marriage and have it succeed. It's really cool when you see it. You know, a good example, something like Avatar.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. That's a great example. All right, well, I think that does it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
If any of our listeners wanted to find your books or reach out to you, where could they find you at?
They can find me. They can find my books on Amazon as well as many other outlets. And they can find me at my website at jamesmaxwell.com.
Okay.
Awesome.
Excellent.
Thank you, Mr. Maxwell. We're happy to have you on.
Yep, we very much enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
And we're back. Thank you again to James Maxwell for talking to us, for chatting with us. Thankfully, this was not another 6 a.m. interview we did.
We appreciate that flexibility.
We appreciate that very much. We really hope you guys enjoyed that interview as well. Like we said, please go check out Mr. Maxwell. He's worked very hard on these series, and he sounds like he has a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. I look forward to seeing what he's got coming up next.
I want to go to Malta. Right. He made it sound fun.
Right?
Well, I think that does it for us this week.
That does. Next week, we're going to be having some fun next week.
Yeah.
We are actually going to be reading Ready Player One by Ernest Cline, with the movie coming out next Friday, I believe.
And Danny,
it's coming Friday.
We'll get past page 5.
It was like 50.
Okay.
It was like 50.
So page 6.
No, I am. I'm going to read a lot more of it than I did last time.
Yep.
Because I really want to know what all the hype is about, really.
I'm expecting some fuck this asshole text at the beginning.
I did not know. Oh, well, I knew Will Wheaton narrates the book, the audiobook.
Nice.
But there's actually a Will Wheaton reference in the book.
Nice. You got to imagine the smile on his face when he read that.
I think that's why he took the job.
Yeah. Very nice. Very nice.
So we're going to do that, and we're going to go watch the movie, so we'll be able to do a film book to film adaptation discussion there.
I'm worried about the movie, because I'm worried it's going to be a bunch of Easter egg. Look, this is cool from video games. Hey, that's cool from it. Look, it's the Pong guy. You know, because there's probably a Pong guy.
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll find out.
All right. So that's what we have going on next week.
Woo.
Once again, please go check us out on Twitter. Mm-hmm. That's at BookGeeksUNC. You can contact us there. We have a Facebook group, the Book Geeks Uncompromised group. If you would like to check out James Maxwell's books, there will be links to them in the show notes, as well as on Goodreads. I think I'll have them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There will be links to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Book Depository. So you can find his works there if you'd like to check those out.
Mm-hmm.
That about does it for this week.
Yep.
Anything else to add?
All I've got is about Audible. Don't forget to go and try out a free 30-day trial. www.audibletrial.com/bookgeeksuncompromised.
Yes. And absolutely.
Oh, sorry. Book Geeks UNC.
Book Geeks UNC. Definitely come check us out on Facebook. We have our Facebook group.
We're having
Facebook
so much fun talking to you guys.
Yes. We love the chats that we have on there. So come join us. Come post on there. Tell us what you're reading.
Yep.
What books do you love? What books do you hate? What things do you love in books? What do you hate in some genres?
You'll see Danny post. Everything. You'll see Danny post interesting news articles, and then I'll post Brandon Sanderson stuff. That's exactly
what happens. Yeah, that's accurate.
Yep, it's pretty awesome.
Okay, so thank you for listening to us ramble on tonight.
Yep, it was good times. And again, thank you to James Maxwell.
All right, we will see y'all later.